Chapter 74. Though his will be good, his spirit and his prophecies are illusions of the devil. They are capable of deceiving many curious people and of causing great harm and scandal to the Church of our Lord God. Opinion on Guillaume Postel, sent to Ignatius Loyola by the Jesuit fathers Salmeron, Lust, and Ugoletto, May 10, 1545. Belbo, detached, told us what he had concocted, but he didn't read his pages to us and eliminated all personal references. Indeed, he led us to believe that Abulafia had supplied him with the connections. The idea that Bacon was the author of the Rosicrucian manifestos he had already come upon somewhere or other, but one thing in particular struck me, that Bacon was Viscount St. Albans. It buzzed in my head. It had something to do with my old thesis. I spent that night digging in my card file. "Gentlemen," I said to my accomplices with a certain solemnity the next morning, "we don't have to invent connections. They exist. When, in 1164, St. Bernard launched the idea of a council at Troyes to legitimize the Templars, among those charged to organize everything was the Prior of St. Albans. St. Alban was the first English martyr who evangelized the British Isles. He lived in Verulamium, which became Bacon's property. He was a Celt and unquestionably a Druid initiate, like St. Bernard." "That's not very much," Belbo said. "Wait. This Prior of St. Albans was Abbot of Saint-Martin-des-Champs, the abbey where the Conservatoire des Arts et Métiers was later installed." Belbo reacted. "My God!" "And that's not all," I said. "The Conservatoire was conceived as homage to Bacon. On 25 Brumaire of the year 111, the convention authorized its Comité d'Instruction Publique to have the complete works of Bacon printed. And on 18 Vendémiaire of the same year, the same convention had passed a law providing for the construction of a house of arts and trades that would reproduce the House of Solomon as described by Bacon in his New Atlantis, a place where all the inventions of mankind are collected." "And so?" Diotalevi asked. "The pendulum is in the Conservatoire," Belbo said. And from Diotalevi's reaction, I realized that Belbo had told him about Foucault's pendulum. "Not so fast," I said. "The pendulum was invented and installed only in the last century. We should skip it." "Skip it?" Belbo said. "Haven't you ever seen the monad hieroglyph of John Dee? The talisman that is supposed to concentrate all the wisdom of the universe? Doesn't it look like a pendulum?" "All right," I said. "Let's suppose a connection can be established. But how do we go from St. Albans to the pendulum?" I was to learn how in the space of a few days. "So then, the Prior of St. Albans is the Abbot of Saint-Martin-des-Champs, which therefore becomes a Templar center. Bacon, through his property, establishes a contact with the Druid followers of St. Albans. Now listen carefully. As Bacon is beginning his career in England, Guillaume Postel in France is ending his." An almost imperceptible twitch on Belbo's face. I recalled the dialogue at Ricardo's show. Postel made Belbo think of the man who, in his mind, had robbed him of Lorenza. But it was the matter of an instant. "Postel studies Hebrew, tries to demonstrate that it's the common matrix of all languages, translates the Zohar and the Bahir, has contacts with the Kabbalists, broaches a plan for universal peace similar to that of the German Rosicrucian groups, tries to convince the King of France to form an alliance with the Sultan, visits Greece, Syria, Asia Minor, studies Arabic. In a word, he retraces the itinerary of Christian Rosenkreuz. And it is no accident that he signs some writings with the name of Rosis Perdus, he who scatters dew. Gassendi, in his Examen Philosophiae Fludanae, says that Rosenkreuz does not derive from Rosa, but from Rose, dew. In one of his manuscripts, he speaks of a secret to be guarded until the time is ripe, and he says that pearls may not be cast before swine. Do you know where else this gospel quotation appears? On the title page of The Chemical Wedding. And Father Moran Merzen, in denouncing the Rosicrucian flood, says he is made of the same stuff as Ateus Magnus Postel. Furthermore, it seems Dee and Postel met in 1550, but perhaps they didn't yet know that they were both grand masters of the plan, scheduled to meet 30 years later in 1584. Now, Postel declares, hear ye, that being a direct descendant of the oldest son of Noah, and since Noah is the founder of the Celtic race and therefore of the civilization of the Druids, the King of France is the only legitimate pretender to the title King of the World." "That's right, he talks about the King of the World. But 3 centuries before, D'Alvedre. We'll skip the fact that he falls in love with an old hag, Joanna, and considers her the divine Sophia. The man probably didn't have all his marbles. But powerful enemies he did have. They called him dog, execrable monster, cloaca of all heresies, a being possessed by a legion of demons. All the same, even with the Joanna scandal, the Inquisition doesn't consider him a heretic. Only Amen's a bit of a nut, let's say. The truth is, the Church doesn't dare destroy the man because they know he's the spokesman of some fairly powerful group. I would point out to you, Diotelevi, that Postel travels also in the Orient and is a contemporary of Isaac Luria. Draw whatever conclusions you like. Well, in 1564, the year in which D writes his Monus Hieroglyphica, Postel retracts his heresies and retires to, guess where, the monastery of Saint-Martin-des-Champs. What's he waiting for? Obviously, he's waiting for 1584. Obviously, Diotelevi said. I went on. Are we agreed, then? Postel is Grand Master of the French group, awaiting the appointment with the English. But he dies in 1581, 3 years before it. Conclusions? First, the 1584 mishap took place because at that crucial moment, a keen mind was missing, since Postel would have been able to figure out what was going on in the confusion of the calendars. Second, Saint-Martin was a place where the Templars were safe, always at home, where the man responsible for the third meeting immured himself and waited. Saint-Martin-des-Champs was the refuge. It all fits like a mosaic. Stick with me. At the time of the failed appointment, Bacon is only 23, but in 1621 he becomes Viscount St. Albans. What does he find in the ancestral possessions? A mystery. Note that this is the year he is accused of corruption and imprisoned for a while. He had unearthed something that caused fear in someone. In whom? This is when Bacon understood that Saint-Martin should be watched. He conceived the idea of putting his House of Solomon there, the laboratory in which, through experimental means, the secret could be discovered. But, Diotelevi asked, how do we find the link between Bacon's followers and the revolutionary groups of the late 18th century? Could Freemasonry be the answer? Belbo said. Splendid idea. Actually, Allier suggested it to us that night at the castle. We should reconstruct the events. What exactly was going on then in those circles? Chapter 75. The only ones who elude the eternal sleep are those who in life are able to orient their mind toward the higher way. The initiates, the adepts, are at the edge of that path. Having achieved memory, anamnesis, in the expression of Plutarch, they become free, they proceed without bonds. Crowned, they celebrate the mysteries and see on earth the throng of those who are not initiated and are not pure, those who are crushed and pushing one another in the mud and in the darkness. Julius Evola, La Tradizione Ermetica, Rome, Edizioni Mediterranee, 1971, page 111. Rashly, I volunteered to do some quick research. I soon regretted it. I found myself in a morass of books in which it was difficult to distinguish historical fact from hermetic gossip, and reliable information from flights of fancy. Working like a machine for a week, I drew up a bewildering list of sects, lodges, conventicles. I occasionally shuddered on encountering familiar names I didn't expect to come upon in such company, and there were chronological coincidences that I felt were curious enough to be noted down. I showed this document to my two accomplices. 1645, London. Ashmole founds Invisible College, Rosicrucian in inspiration. 1660, from the Invisible College is born the Royal Society, and from the Royal Society, as everyone knows, the Masons. 1666, Paris, founding of Académie Royale des Sciences. 1707, birth of Claude-Louis de Saint-Germain, if he was really born. 1717, creation of the Great Lodge in London. 1721, Anderson drafts the Constitutions of English Masonry. Initiated in London, Peter the Great founds a lodge in Russia. 1730, Montesquieu, passing through London, is initiated. 1737, Ramsay asserts the Templar origin of Masonry, origin of the Scottish Rite, henceforth in conflict with the Great Lodge of London. 1738, Frederick, then Crown Prince of Prussia, is initiated. Later, he is patron of encyclopedists. 1740, various lodges created in France around this year. Écossais Fidèles of Toulouse, Souverain Conseil Sublime, Mère Loge Écossaise du Grand Globe Français, Collège des Sublimes Princes du Royal Secret of Bordeaux, Cour des Souverains Commandeurs du Temple of Carcassonne, Philadelphe of Narbonne, Chapitre des Rosecroix of Montpellier, Sublime Élu de la Vérité. 1743, first public appearance of Comte de Saint-Germain. In Lyon, the degree of Chevalier Cadoche originates, its task being to vindicate Templars. 1753, Villermoz founds Lodge of Parfaite Amitié. 1754, Martinez Pasqualis founds Temple of the Élu Cohen, perhaps in 1760. 1756, Baron von Hundt founds Templar Strict Observance, inspired, some say, by Frederick II of Prussia. For the first time, there is talk of the unknown superiors. Some insinuate that the unknown superiors are Frederick and Voltaire. 1758, Saint-Germain arrives in Paris and offers his services to the king as chemist, an expert in dyes. He spends time with Madame Pompadour. 1759, presumed formation of Conseil des Empereurs d'Orient et d'Occident, which 3 years later is said to have drawn up the Constitution et Règlement de Bordeaux, from which ancient and accepted Scottish Rite probably originates, though this does not appear officially till 1801. 1760, Saint-Germain on ambiguous diplomatic mission in Holland, forced to flee, arrested in London, released. Dom J. Pernetti founds Illuminati of Avignon. Martinez Pasqualis founds Chevalier Maçon Élu de l'Univers. 1762, Saint-Germain in Russia. 1763, Casanova meets Saint-Germain as Surmont in Belgium. Latter turns coin into gold. Villermoz founds Souverain Chapitre des Chevaliers d'Aigle Noir Rosecroix. 1768, Villermoz joins Pasqualis's Élu Cohen, apocryphal publication in Jerusalem of Les plus secrets mystères des hauts grades de la maçonnerie dévoilée, ou Le vrai Rosecroix. It says that the Lodge of the Rosicrucians is on Mount Herodon, 60 miles from Edinburgh. Pasqualis meets Louis-Claude de Saint-Martin, later known as Le Philosophe Inconnu. Dom Pernetti becomes librarian of King of Prussia. 1771. The Duc de Chartres, later known as Philippe Égalité, becomes Grand Master of the Grand Orient, then the Grand Orient de France, and tries to unify all the lodges. Scottish Rite Lodge resists. 1772. Pasqualis leaves for Santo Domingo, and Villermoz and Saint-Martin establish Tribunal Souverain, which becomes Grand Loge Écossaise. 1774. Saint-Martin retires to become Philosophe Inconnu, and as delegate of Templar Strict Observance, goes to negotiate with Villermoz. A Scottish Directory of the province of Auvergne is born. From this will be born the rectified Scottish Rite. 1776. Saint-Germain, under the name Count Welldone, presents chemical plans to Frederick II. Société des Philatètes is born to unite all hermeticists. Lodge of the Neuf Sœurs has as members Guillotin and Cabanis, Voltaire and Franklin. Adam Weishaupt founds Illuminati of Bavaria. According to some, he is initiated by a Danish merchant, Colmer, returning from Egypt, who is probably the mysterious Altotus, master of Cagliostro. 1778. Saint-Germain in Berlin meets Dom Pernetti. Villermoz founds Ordre des Chevaliers Bienfaisants de la Cité Sainte. Templar Strict Observance and Grand Orient agree to accept the rectified Scottish Rite. 1782. Great Conference of all the initiatory lodges at Wilhelmsbad. 1783. Marquis Thome founds the Swedenborg Rite. 1784. Saint-Germain presumably dies while in the service of the Landgrave of Hesse, for whom he is completing a factory for making dyes. 1785. Cagliostro founds Memphis Rite, which later becomes the ancient and primitive rite of Memphis Misraim. It increases the number of high degrees to 90. Scandal of the Affair of the Diamond Necklace, orchestrated by Cagliostro. Dumas describes it as a Masonic plot to discredit the monarchy. The Illuminati of Bavaria are suppressed, suspected of revolutionary plotting. 1786. Mirabeau is initiated by the Illuminati of Bavaria in Berlin. In London, a Rosicrucian manifesto appears, attributed to Cagliostro. Mirabeau writes a letter to Cagliostro and to Lavater. 1787. There are about 700 lodges in France. Weishaupt publishes his Nachtrag, which describes the structure of a secret organization in which each adherent knows only his immediate superior. 1789. French Revolution begins. Crisis in the French lodges. 1794. On Wheat Vendémiaire, Deputy Grégoire presents to the convention the project for a Conservatoire des Arts et Métiers. It is installed in Saint-Martin-des-Champs in 1799 by the Council of 500. The Duke of Brunswick urges lodges to dissolve because a poisonous, subversive sect has now corrupted them all. 1798. Arrest of Cagliostro in Rome. 1804. Announcement in Charleston of official foundation of ancient and accepted Scottish Rite with number of degrees increased to 33. 1824. Document from Court of Vienna to French government denounces secret associations like the Absolutes, the Independents, the Alta Vendita Carbonara. 1835. The Kabbalist Oettinger claims to meet Saint-Germain in Paris. 1846. Viennese writer Franz Grafer publishes account of a meeting of his brother with Saint-Germain between 1788 and 1790. Saint-Germain received his visitor while leaping through a book by Paracelsus. 1865. Foundation of Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia. Other sources give 1860, 1866, or 1867. Bulwer Lytton, author of the Rosicrucian novel Zanoni, joins. 1868. Bakunin founds International Alliance of Socialist Democracy, inspired, some say, by the Illuminati of Bavaria. 1875. Elena Petrovna Blavatsky, with Henry Steele Alcott, founds Theosophical Society. Her Isis Unveiled appears. Baron Spedalieri proclaims himself a member of Grand Lodge of the Solitary Brothers of the Mountain, Frater Illuminatis of the Ancient and Restored Order of the Manichaeans and of the Martinists. 1877. Madame Blavatsky speaks of the theosophical role of Saint-Germain. Among his incarnations are Roger and Francis Bacon, Rosencreutz, Proclus, St. Alban. Grand Orient of France eliminates invocation to the great architect of the universe and proclaims absolute freedom of conscience, breaks ties with Grand Lodge of England, and becomes firmly secular and radical. 1879. Foundation of the Societas Rosicruciana in the USA. 1880, beginning of Saint-Yves d'Alvedre's activity. Leopold Engler reorganizes the Illuminati of Bavaria. 1884, Leo XIII, with the encyclical Humanum Genus, condemns Freemasonry. Catholics desert it, rationalists flock to it. 1888, Stanislas de Gaïta founds Ordre Kabbalistique de la Rose Croix, Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, founded in England with 11 degrees, from neophyte to ipsissimus. Its imperator is MacGregor Mathers, whose sister marries Bergson. 1890, Joseph Péladan, called Joséphin, leaves Gaïta and founds the Rose Croix Catholique du Temple et du Graal, proclaiming himself Tsar Merodach. Conflict between Rosicrucians of Gaïta's order and those of Péladan's is called the War of the Two Roses. 1891, Papus publishes his Traité méthodique de science occulte. 1898, Aleister Crowley initiated into Golden Dawn, later founds Order of Thelema. 1907, from the Golden Dawn is born the Stella Matutina, which Yeats joins. 1909, in the United States, H. Spencer Lewis reawakens the Anticus Mysticus Ordo Rosicrucis, and in 1916, in a hotel, successfully transforms a piece of zinc into gold. Max Heindel founds the Rosicrucian Fellowship. At uncertain dates follow Lectorium Rosicrucianum, Frère Aîné de la Rose Croix, Fraternitas Hermetica, Templum Rosae Crucis. 1912, Annie Besant, disciple of Madame Blavatsky, founds in London Order of the Temple of the Rose Cross. 1918, Thule Society is born in Germany. 1936, in France, Le Grand Prieuré des Gaules is born. In the Cahiers de la Fraternité Polaire, Enrico Contardi-Rodio tells of a visit from Comte de Saint-Germain. "What does all this mean?" Theotilevi said. "Don't ask me. You wanted data? Help yourself. This is all I know." "We'll have to consult Allier. I doubt that even he knows all these organizations." "Wanna bet? They're his daily bread. But we can put him to the test. Let's add a sect that doesn't exist. Founded recently." I recalled the curious question of De Angelis, whether I'd ever heard of the Trace. And I said, "Trace." "What's that?" Balbo asked. "If it's an acrostic, there has to be a subtext," Theotilevi said. "Otherwise my rabbis would not have been able to use the Notaricon. Let's see. Templi resurgentes equites synarchici. That suit you?" "We like the name and put it at the bottom of the list." "With all these conventicles, inventing one more was no mean trick," Theotilevi said in a sudden fit of vanity. Chapter 76. If it were then a matter of defining in one word the dominant characteristic of French Freemasonry in the 18th century, only one would do: dilettantism. René Le Forestier, La Franque Maçonnerie Templière et Occultiste, Paris, Aubier, 1970, 2. The next evening we invited Allier to Pilates. Though the bar's new customers had gone back to jackets and ties, the presence of our guest in blue chalk-striped suit and snow-white shirt, tie fastened with a gold pin, caused eyebrows to be raised. Luckily, at 6 o'clock, Pilates was fairly empty. Allier confused Pilates by ordering a cognac by its brand name. Pilates had it, of course, but the bottle had stood enthroned on the shelf behind the zinc counter, untouched for years. Allier studied the liquor in his glass against the light, then warmed it with his hands, displaying gold cufflinks that were vaguely Egyptian in style. We showed him the list, telling him we had compiled it from the manuscripts of the Diabolicals. The fact that the Templars were connected with the early lodges of the Master Masons established during the construction of Solomon's Temple is certain, he said. And it is equally certain that these associates, on occasion, recalled the murder of the Temple's architect, Hiram, a sacrificial victim. The Masons vowed to avenge him. After their persecution, then, many knights of the Temple must have joined those artisan confraternities, fusing the myth of avenging Hiram with the determination to avenge Jacques de Molay. In the 18th century in London, there were lodges of genuine Masons, and they were called operative lodges. Then, gradually, some idle but thoroughly respectable gentlemen were determined to join operative Masonry, so it became symbolic, philosophical Masonry. In this atmosphere, a certain de Sagulier, popularizer of Newton, encouraged a Protestant pastor, Anderson, to draft the constitutions of a lodge of Mason brothers, deist in persuasion, and Anderson began speaking of the Masonic confraternities as corporations dating back 4,000 years to the founders of the Temple of Solomon. These are the reasons for the Masonic masquerade, the apron, the trowel, the T-square. Masonry became fashionable, attracting the aristocracy with the genealogical tables it hinted at, but it appealed even more to the bourgeoisie, who now not only could hobnob with the nobles, but were actually permitted to wear a short sword. In the wretched modern world at its birth, the nobles need a place where they can come into contact with the new producers of capital, and the new producers of capital are looking to be ennobled. But the Templars seem to have emerged later. The one who first established a direct relation with the Templars, Ramsay, I'd prefer not to discuss. I suspect he was put up to it by the Jesuits. His preaching led to the birth of the Scottish wing of Masonry. Scottish? The Scottish Rite was a Franco-German invention. London Masonry had established 3 degrees, apprentice, fellow craft, and master. Scottish Masonry multiplied the degrees because doing so meant multiplying the levels of initiation and secrecy. The French, congenitally foolish, love secrecy. But what was the secret? There was no secret, obviously. But if there had been one, or if they had possessed it, its complexity would have justified the number of degrees of initiation. Ramsay multiplied the degrees to make others believe he had a secret. You can imagine the thrill of those solid tradesmen, now at last able to become princes of vengeance. Allier was prodigal with Masonic gossip, and in the course of his talk, as was his custom, he slipped gradually into first-person recollection. In those days, in France, they were already writing couplets about the new fashion, the Frimaçon. The lodges, multiplying, attracted monseigneurs, friars, barons, and shopkeepers, and the members of the royal family became grand masters. The Templar strict observance of that Hund character received Goethe, Lessing, Mozart, Voltaire. Lodges sprang up among the military. In the regimental mess, they plotted to avenge Hiram and discuss the coming revolution. For others, masonry was a société de plaisir, a club, a status symbol. You could find a bit of everything there. Cagliostro, Mesmer, Casanova, Baron d'Holbach, d'Alembert, encyclopedists and alchemists, libertines and hermetics. At the outbreak of the revolution, members of the same lodge found themselves on opposite sides, and it seemed that the great brotherhood would never recover from this crisis. Wasn't there a conflict between the Grand Orient and the Scottish Lodge? Only verbally. For example, the Lodge of the Neuf Sœurs welcomed Franklin, whose goals naturally were secular. He was interested only in supporting his American Revolution. But at the same time, one of its grand masters was the Comte de Milly, who was seeking the elixir of longevity. Since he was an imbecile, in the course of his experiments he poisoned himself and died. Or take Cagliostro. On the one hand, he invented Egyptian rites. On the other, he was implicated in the affair of the diamond necklace, a scandal devised by the rising bourgeoisie to discredit the Ancien Régime. And Cagliostro was indeed involved. Just try to imagine the sort of people one had to live with. It must have been hard, Belbo said with comprehension. But who, I asked, are these barons von Hund who seek the unknown superiors? New groups sprang up at the time of the necklace farce, altogether different in nature. To gain adepts, they identified themselves with the Masonic lodges, but actually they were pursuing more mystical ends. It was at this point that the debate about the unknown superiors took place. Hund, unfortunately, wasn't a serious person. At first he led his adepts to believe that the unknown superiors were the Stuarts. Then he said that the aim of the order was to rescue the original possessions of the Templars, and he scraped together funds from all sides. Unsatisfied with the proceeds, he fell into the hands of a man named Stark, who claimed to have learned the secret of making gold from the authentic unknown superiors, who were in Petersburg. Hund and Stark were surrounded by theosophists, cheap alchemists, last-minute Rosicrucians. Altogether they elected as Grand Master a thoroughly upright man, the Duke of Brunswick. He immediately realized that he was in the worst possible company. One of the members of the strict observance, the Landgrave of Hesse, summoned the Comte de Saint-Germain, believing this gentleman could produce gold for him. And why not? In those days, the whims of the mighty had to be indulged. But the Landgrave also believed himself to be St. Peter. I assure you, gentlemen, once when Lavater was the Landgrave's guest, he had a dreadful time with the Duchess of Devonshire, who thought she was Mary Magdalene. But what about this Villermoz and this Martinez Pasquales, who founded one sect after another? Pasquales was an old pirate. He practiced theurgical operations in a secret chamber, and angelic spirits appeared to him in the form of luminous trails and hieroglyphic characters. Villermoz took him seriously because he himself was an enthusiast, honest but naive. Fascinated by alchemy, Villermoz dreamed of a great work, to which the elect should devote themselves. To discover the point of alliance of the six noble metals through studying the measurements comprised in the six letters of the original name of God, which Solomon had allowed his elect to know. And then? Villermoz founded many orders and joined many lodges at the same time, as was the custom in those days, always seeking the definitive revelation, always fearing it was hidden elsewhere, which indeed is the case. That is perhaps the only truth. So he joined the Eleucoon of Pasquales. But in 72, Pasquales disappeared, sailed for Santo Domingo, and left everything up in the air. Why did he leave? I suspect he came into possession of a secret he didn't want to share. In any case, requiescat, he disappeared on that dark continent into well-deserved darkness. And Villermoz? In that year, we had all been shaken by the death of Swedenborg, a man who could have taught many things to the ailing West had the West listened to him. But now the century began its headlong race toward revolutionary madness, following the ambitions of the Third Estate. It was then that Villermoz heard about Hund's rite of the strict observance, and was fascinated by it. He was told that a Templar who reveals himself, by founding a public association, say, is not a Templar. But the 18th century was an era of great credulity. VMOs created with Hunt the various alliances that appear on your list until Hunt was unmasked. I mean, until they discovered he was the sort who runs off with the cash box. And the Duke of Brunswick expelled him from the organization. Allier cast another glance at the list.
Oh, yes, Weishaupt. I nearly forgot. The Illuminati of Bavaria.
With a name like that, they attracted at the beginning a number of generous minds. But Weishaupt was an anarchist. Today we'd call him a communist, and if you gentlemen only knew the things they raved about in that ambience. Coup d'état, dethroning sovereigns, bloodbaths. Mind you, I admired Weishaupt a great deal, not for his ideas, but for his extremely clear-headed view of how a secret society should function. It's possible to have a splendid organizational talent, but quite confused ideas. In short, the Duke of Brunswick, seeing the confusion around him left by Hunt, realized that at this juncture there were three conflicting currents in the German Masonic world. The sapiential occultist camp, including some Rosicrucians, the rationalist camp, and the anarchist revolutionary camp of the Illuminati of Bavaria. He proposed that the various orders and rites meet at Wilhelmsbad for a convent, as they were then called, an estates general, you might say. The following questions had to be answered. Does the order truly originate from an ancient society, and if so, which? Are there really unknown superiors, keepers of the ancient tradition, and if so, who are they? What are the true aims of the order? Is the chief aim to restore the order of the Templars? And so forth, including the problem of whether the order should concern itself with the occult sciences. VMOs joined in, enthusiastic, hoping to find at last the answers to the questions he had been asking himself all his life. And here the Demestre affair began.
"Which Demestre?" I asked.
"Joseph or Xavier?"
"Joseph."
"The reactionary?" If he was reactionary, he wasn't reactionary enough. "A curious man. Consider, this devout son of the Catholic Church, just when the first popes were beginning to issue bulls against Masonry, became a member of a lodge, assuming the name Josephus a Pluribus. He approached Masonry in 1773, when a papal brief condemned the Jesuits. Of course it was the Scottish lodges that Demestre approached, since he was not a bourgeois follower of the Enlightenment, he was an Illuminato." Allier sipped his cognac. From a cigarette case of almost white metal, he took out some cigarillos of an unusual shape. "A tobacconist in London makes them for me," he said, "like the cigars you found at my house. Please, they're excellent." He spoke with his eyes lost in memory. "Demestre, a man of exquisite manners. To listen to him was a spiritual pleasure. He gained great authority in occult circles. And yet, at Wilhelmsbad, he betrayed our expectations. He sent a letter to the Duke in which he firmly renounced any Templar affiliation, abjured the unknown superiors, and denied the utility of the esoteric sciences. He rejected it all out of loyalty to the Catholic Church, but he did so with the arguments of a bourgeois encyclopedist. When the Duke read the letter to a small circle of intimates, no one wanted to believe it. Demestre now asserted that the order's aim was nothing but spiritual regeneration, and that the ceremonials and the traditional rites served only to keep the mystical spirit alive. He praised all the new Masonic symbols, but said that an image that represented several things no longer represented anything, which, you'll forgive me, runs counter to the whole Hermetic tradition, for the more ambiguous and elusive a symbol is, the more it gains significance and power. Otherwise, what becomes of the spirit of Hermes, god of a thousand faces? Apropos of the Templars, Demestre said that the order of the Temple had been created by greed, and greed had destroyed it, and that was that. The Savoyard could not forget, you see, that the order had been destroyed with the consent of the Pope. Never trust Catholic legitimists, no matter how ardent their hermetic vocation. Demestre's dismissal of the unknown superiors was also laughable. The proof that they do not exist is that we have no knowledge of them. We could not have knowledge of them, of course, or they would not be unknown. Odd how a believer of such fiber could be impermeable to the sense of mystery. Then Demestre made his final appeal. Let us return to the Gospels and abandon the follies of Memphis. He was simply restating the millennial line of the Church. You can understand the atmosphere in which the Wilhelmsbad meeting took place. With the defection of an authority like Demestre, VMOs would be in the minority. At most, a compromise could be reached. The Templar rite was maintained. Any conclusion about the origins of the order was postponed. In short, the convent was a failure. That was the moment the Scottish branch missed its opportunity.
If things had gone differently, the history of the following century might have been different.
And afterward, I asked, was nothing patched together again?
What was there to patch, to use your word? 3 years later, an evangelical preacher who had joined the Illuminati of Bavaria, a certain Lanza, died in a wood struck by lightning. Instructions of the order were found on him. The Bavarian government intervened. It was discovered that Weishaupt was plotting against the state, and the order was suppressed the following year. And further, Weishaupt's writings were published, containing the alleged projects of the Illuminati, and for a whole century they discredited all French and German Neo-Templarism. It's possible that Weishaupt's Illuminati were really on the side of Jacobin Masonry and had infiltrated the Neo-Templar branch to destroy it. It was probably not by chance that this evil breed had attracted Mirabeau, the Tribune of the Revolution, to its side.
May I say something in confidence?
Please.
Men like me, interested in joining together again the fragments of a lost tradition, are bewildered by an event like Wilhelmsbad. Some guessed and remained silent, some knew and lied, and then it was too late. First the revolutionary whirlwind, then the uproar of 19th-century occultism. Look at your list, a festival of bad faith and credulity, petty spite, reciprocal excommunications, secrets that circulated on every tongue, the theater of occultism.
Occultists seem fickle, wouldn't you say? Belbo remarked.
You must be able to distinguish occultism from esotericism. Esotericism is the search for a learning transmitted only through symbols, closed to the profane. The occultism that spread in the 19th century was the tip of the iceberg, the little that surfaced of the esoteric secret. The Templars were initiates, and the proof of that is that when subjected to torture, they died to save their secret. It is the strength with which they concealed it that makes us sure of their initiation, and that makes us yearn to know what they knew. The occultist is an exhibitionist. As Peladon said, an initiatory secret revealed is of no use to anyone. Unfortunately, Peladon was not an initiate, but an occultist. The 19th century was the century of informers. Everybody rushed to publish the secrets of magic, theurgy, Kabbalah, tarot, and perhaps they believed in it.
Allier continued looking over our list with an occasional snicker of commiseration.
Elena Petrovna, a good woman at heart, but she never said a thing that hadn't already been written everywhere.
Gaeta, a drug addict bibliomane.
Papus, what a character!
Then he stopped abruptly.
Trace, where does this come from? Which manuscript?
Good, I thought. He's noticed the interpolation.
I answered vaguely. Well, we've put together the list from so many texts. Most of them have already been returned. They were plain rubbish. Do you recall, Belbo, where this trace comes from?
I don't think I do, Diotelevi.
Oh, it was days ago. Is it important?
Not at all, Avier said. It's just that I never heard of it before.
You really can't tell me who mentioned it?
We were terribly sorry. We didn't remember.
Allier took his watch from his vest. Heavens, I have another engagement. You gentlemen will forgive me.
He left, and we stayed on, talking. It's all clear now. The English Templars put forth the Masonic proposal in order to make all the initiates of Europe rally around the Baconian plan. But the plan only half succeeds. The idea of the Baconians is so fascinating that it produces results contrary to their expectations. The so-called Scottish line sees the new conventicle as a way to re-establish the succession, and it makes contact with the German Templars.
To Allier, what happened made no sense, but it's obvious. To us now, the various national groups entered the lists, one against the other. I wouldn't be surprised if Martinus Pasqualis was an agent of the Tomar group. The English rejected the Scottish. Then there were the French, obviously divided into two groups, pro-English and pro-German. Masonry was the cover, the pretext behind which all these agents of different groups, God knows where the Paulicians and the Jerusalemites were, met and clashed, each trying to tear a piece of the secret from the others.
Masonry was like Rick's in Casablanca, Belbo said, which turns upside down the common view that it is a secret society.
No, no, it's a free port, a Macau, a facade. The secret is elsewhere.
Poor Masons.
Progress demands its victims, but you must admit we are uncovering an imminent rationality of history. The rationality of history is the result of a good recombining of the Torah, Diotalevi said, and that's what we're doing, and blessed be the name of the Most High.
All right, Belbo said. Now the Baconians have Saint-Martin-des-Champs, while the Franco-Roman Neo-Templar line is breaking down into 100 sects, and we still haven't decided what this secret is all about.
That's up to you two, Diotalevi said.
Us two? All three of us are in this. If we don't come out honorably, we'll all look silly.
Silly to whom?
Why, to history, before the Tribunal of Truth.
Quid est veritas? Belbo asked.
Us, I said. Chapter 77. This herb is called devilbane by the philosophers. It has been demonstrated that only its seed can expel devils and their hallucinations. When given to a young woman who was tormented by a devil during the night, this herb made him flee. Johannes de Rupicisa, Tractatus de Quinta Essentia. 2. During the next few days, I neglected the plan. Leah's pregnancy was coming to term, and whenever possible, I stayed with her. I was anxious, but she calmed me, saying the time had not yet come. She was taking a course in painless childbirth, and I was trying to follow her exercises. Leah had rejected science's offer to tell us the baby's sex in advance. She wanted to be surprised. Accepting this eccentricity on her part, I touched her belly and did not ask myself what would come out. We called it the thing. I asked how I could take part in the birth. It's mine too, this thing, I said. I don't want to be one of those movie fathers pacing up and down the corridor chain-smoking.
Pow, there's only so much you can do. The moment comes when it's all up to me. Besides, you don't smoke. Surely you're not going to start smoking just for this occasion.
What'll I do, then?
You'll take part before and afterward. Afterward, if it's a boy, you'll teach him, guide him, give him a fine old Oedipus complex in the usual way. With a smile, you'll play out the ritual parricide when the time comes. No fuss. And at some point, you'll show him your squalid office, the card files, the page proofs of the wonderful adventure of metals, and you'll say to him, "My son, one day all this will be yours."
And if it's a girl?
You'll say to her, "My daughter, one day all this will be your no-good husband's."
And what do I do before?
During labor, between one wave of pain and the next, you have to count, because as the interval grows shorter, the moment approaches. We'll count together, and you'll set the rhythm for me, like rowers in a galley. It'll be as if you too were coaxing the thing out from its dark lair. Poor little thing. Feel it. Now it's so cozy there in the dark, sucking up humors like an octopus, all free, and then, wham, it pops out into the daylight, blinks, and says, "Where the hell am I?"
Poor little thing. And it hasn't even met Signor Garamond. Come on, let's rehearse the counting part.
We counted in the darkness, holding hands. I daydreamed. The thing, with its birth, would give reality and meaning to all the old wives' tales of the diabolicals. Poor diabolicals who spent their nights enacting chemical weddings with the hope that 18-karat gold would result, and wondering if the Philosopher's Stone was really the lapis exilis, a wretched terracotta grail. And my grail was in Leah's belly.
"Yes," Leah said, running her hand over her swelling taut vessel. "Here is where your good primal matter is steeping. Those people you saw at the castle, what did they think happened in the vessel?"
"Oh, they thought that melancholy was grumbling in it. Sulphurous earth, black lead, oil of Saturn, the sticks of purifications, distillations, pulverizations, ablutions, liquefactions, submersions, terra fetida, stinking sepulchre."
"What are they, impotent? Don't they know that in the vessel our thing ripens, all white and pink and beautiful?"
"They know, but for them your dear little belly is also a metaphor, full of secrets."
"There are no secrets, Pow. We know exactly how the thing is formed, its little nerves and muscles, its little eyes and spleens and pancreases."
"Oh my God, more than one spleen? What is it, Rosemary's baby?"
"I was speaking in general.
But of course we'll have to be ready to love it, even if it has two heads."
"Of course. I'll teach it to play duets, trumpet and clarinet."
"No, then it would need four hands, that's too many. But come to think about it, he'd make a great pianist."
"A concerto for two left hands? Nothing to it."
"Brr."
"But then, my diabolicals also know that on that day in the hospital there will be born the great work, the white, the rebus, the androgen."
"That's all we need. Listen, we'll call him Julio, or her, Julia, after my grandfather. What do you say?
I like it. Good.
If I had only stopped there, if I had only written a white book, a good grimoire, for all the adepts of Isis Unveiled, explaining to them that the secretum secretorum no longer needed to be sought, that the Book of Life contained no hidden meaning. It was all there, in the bellies of all the Leahs of the world, in the hospital rooms, on straw pallets, on river banks, and that the stones in exile and the Holy Grail were nothing but screaming monkeys with their umbilical cords still dangling and the doctor giving them a slap on the ass. And that the unknown superiors in the eyes of the thing were only me and Leah, and the thing would immediately recognize us without having to go ask that old fool Demestra. But no, we, the sardonic, insisted on playing games with the diabolicals, and showing them that if there had to be a cosmic plot, we could invent the most cosmic of all. "Serves you right," I said to myself that other evening. "Now here you are, waiting for what will happen under Foucault's pendulum." Chapter 78. Surely this monstrous hybrid comes not from a mother's womb, but from an Ephialtes, an incubus, or some other horrendous demon, as though spawned in a putrid and venomous fungus, son of fauns and nymphs, more devil than man. Athanasius Kircher, Mundus Subterraneus, Amsterdam, Janssen, 1665, Roman 2, pages 279 to 280. That day I wanted to stay home. I had a presentiment, but Leah told me to stop acting the prince consort and go to work. "There's time, pal. It won't be born yet. I have to go out, too. Run along." I had almost reached my office when Signor Salon's door opened. The old man appeared in his yellow apron. I couldn't avoid greeting him, and he asked me to come inside. I had never seen his laboratory. It must have been an apartment once, but Salon had had all the dividing walls demolished, and what I saw was a cave, vast, hazy. For some obscure architectural reason, this wing of the building had a mansard roof, and the light entered obliquely. I don't know whether the glass panes were dirty or frosted, or if Salon had installed shades to keep out the direct sun, or if it was the heap of objects on all sides proclaiming a fear of spaces left empty. But the light in the cave was late dusk. The room was divided by old pharmacy shelves in which arches opened to passages, junctions, perspectives. The dominant color was brown. The objects, the shelves, the tables, the diffuse blend of light and the patchy illumination from old lamps. My first impression was of having entered an instrument maker's atelier, abandoned from the time of Stradivarius, with years of accumulated dust on the striated bellies of the lutes. Then, as my eyes gradually adjusted, I saw that I was in a petrified zoo. A bear cub with glassy eyes climbed an artificial bough. A dazed and hieratic owl stood beside me. On the table in front of me was a weasel, or marten, or skunk, I couldn't tell. Behind it was a prehistoric animal, feline, its bones showing. It might have been a puma, a leopard, or a very big dog. Part of the skeleton had already been covered with straw and paste, and it was all supported by an iron armature. "The Great Dane of a rich lady with a soft heart," Salon said with a snicker, "who wants to remember it as it was in the days of their conjugal life. You see? You skin the animal. On the inside of the skin you smear arsenic soap. Then you soak and bleach the bones. Look at that shelf and you'll see a great collection of spinal columns and rib cages. A lovely ossuary, don't you think? You connect the bones with wire, reconstruct the skeleton, mount it on an armature. To stuff it, I use hay, paper mache, or plaster. Finally, you fit the skin back on. I repair the damage done by death and corruption. This owl, doesn't it seem alive to you?" From then on, every live owl would seem dead to me, consigned by Salon to a sclerotic eternity. I regarded the face of that embalmer of animal pharaohs, his bushy eyebrows, his gray cheeks, and I could not decide whether he was a living being or a masterpiece of his own art. The better to look at him, I took a step backward and felt something graze my nape. I turned with a shudder and saw I had set a pendulum in motion. A great disemboweled bird swayed, following the movement of the lance that pierced it. The weapon had entered the head, and through the open breast you could see it pass where the heart and gizzard had once been, then branch out to form an upside-down trident. One thicker prong went through the now empty belly and pointed toward the ground like a sword, while the two other prongs entered the feet and emerged symmetrically from the talons. The bird swung, and the three points cast their shadow on the floor, a mystic sign.
"A fine specimen of the Golden Eagle," Salon said. "But I still have a few days' work to do on it. I was just choosing the eyes."
He showed me a box full of glass corneas and pupils, as if the executioner of St. Lucy had collected the trophies of his entire career. "It's not always easy, as it is with insects, where all you need is a box and a pin. This, for example, has to be treated with formalin."
I smelled its morgue odor.
"It must be an enthralling job," I said. And meanwhile I was thinking of the living creature that throbbed in Leah's belly. A chilling thought seized me. "If the thing dies," I said to myself, "I want to bury it. I want it to feed the worms underground and enrich the earth. That's the only way I'll feel it's still alive."
Salon was still talking. He took a strange specimen from one of the shells. It was about 30 centimeters long. A dragon, a reptile with black membranous wings, a cock's crest, and gaping jaws that bristled with tiny saw-like teeth.
"Handsome, isn't he? My own composition. I used a salamander, a bat, snake scales, a subterranean dragon. I was inspired by this."
He showed me on another table a great folio volume bound in ancient parchment with leather ties.
"It cost me a fortune. I'm not a bibliophile, but this was something I had to have. It's the Mundus Subterraneus of Athanasius Kircher, first edition, 1665. Here's the dragon. Identical, don't you think? It lives in the caves of volcanoes, that good Jesuit said, and he knew everything about the known, the unknown, and the non-existent."
"You always think of the underground world," I said, recalling our conversation in Munich and the words I had overheard through the ear of Dionysius. He opened the volume to another page, to an image of the globe, which looked like an anatomical organ, swollen and black, covered by a spiderweb of luminescent serpentine veins.
"If Kircher was right, there are more paths in the heart of the earth than there are on the surface. Whatever takes place in nature derives from the heat and steam below."
I thought of the black work of Leah's belly, of the thing that was struggling to break out of its sweet volcano.
"And whatever takes place in the world of men is planned below."
"Does Padre Kircher say that, too?"
"No, he concerns himself only with nature. But it is odd that the second part of this book is on alchemy and the alchemists, and that precisely here, you see, there is an attack on the Rosicrucians. Why attack the Rosicrucians in a book on the underground world? Our Jesuit knew a thing or two. He knew that the last Templars had taken refuge in the underground kingdom of Agartha."
"And they're still there, it seems," I ventured.
"They're still there," Salon said. "Not in Agartha, but in tunnels. Perhaps beneath us, right here. Milan, too, has a metro. Who decided on it? Who directed the excavations?"
Expert engineers, I'd say."
"Yes, cover your eyes with your hands. And meanwhile, in that firm of yours, you publish such books. How many Jews are there among your authors?"
"We don't ask our authors to fill out racial forms," I replied stiffly.
"You mustn't think me an anti-Semite. Know some of my best friends. But I have in mind a certain kind of Jew."
"What kind?"
"I know what kind."